we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, April 20th, 2018. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And Allison Cole.
Happy Earth Day.
Guest co-host Carol Davies McIntosh.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Amir Ali.
Good afternoon.
Today happens to be Amir's birthday. Happy birthday, Amir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming here on your birthday, too.
Yeah.
It's so much appreciated.
This is our
Thank you so much for coming here on your birthday, too.
Yeah.
It's so much appreciated.
This is our annual Earth Day show as well. Earth Day is coming up this Sunday, April 22nd. Today, we'll be exploring some of the many ways in which adopting a plant-based diet and vegan lifestyle can help to mitigate the effects of climate change and save our precious planet. We'll hear from prominent thinkers George Monbiot and Jane Goodall on this topic and share some compelling information on how animal agriculture plays a major role in driving climate change, water pollution, air pollution, and other environmental problems. But first, I want to welcome again our guest co-host today, Carol Davies McIntosh, who is new to Animal Voices. Carol, I'm curious about your vegan journey. What led you to becoming vegan and getting involved in animal advocacy?
Well, it's been a really long journey for me. It goes back to when I was just a little one. I can remember when I was 4 or 5 years old, loving all animals that I came across. In fact, much to my parents' chagrin, when we went camping, I would try to run into the bush to hug the bears and whatnot. So my dad would come flailing out with a broom or something to get the bear away from me.
Wow.
But I just had no fear, and I just had a really strong affinity for them. I wanted to actually have, and I planned this with the little boy next door, we were going to have a farm when we grew up and have happy animals all over the farm. And so that's actually a dream that I still have, and I've been actually looking for property to start a little rescue farm. But
wow,
as we know, it's pretty expensive. Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts do you live now? Do you live in the city or in the suburbs?
I live in Coquitlam.
Okay, so
right now. So I'm looking out.
You have to look for land that's
further
zoned
out.
Farm for farming.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's right for the animals, yeah. So still looking. No, haven't given up on that dream.
That's fantastic.
I guess when, by the time I was kind of a young teen, I was started to struggle with the idea of eating animals. So came from a traditional North American family, you know, ate every meal had some kind of meat or cheese or something. I would start to question. I questioned my parents about it, and they would say, well, you know, we raise the animals for that. That's what they're there for. Mm-hmm. And there was no talk about how the animals were suffering or any of that kind of stuff. Mind you, this was years and years ago. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of information out there about, and probably it wasn't quite as horrible as it is now.
Right.
We didn't have the huge factory farms. When I was about 11, I guess, we were on a camping trip and we were out in the country, and I met these calves, and I used to go visit them every day. We were there for about a month, and I went down the road and visited the calves, and I got to know them. They'd come over to the fence and I'd pat their little noses, and I started then to put it together that these calves were also the same animal that was ending up on my plate as beef. And it was disturbing to me, and I was talking about it to my parents and to other adults, and they kept kind of suppressing it for me. So I kept eating meat until I became a young adult. I was about 20, 21, and I moved out of the house. And so I decided I didn't want to eat meat anymore. So I stopped eating meat, but I was still eating fish. Mm-hmm. So I was a pescatarian. And I just didn't have the affinity for fish. Like, they're not warm and cuddly and all that kind of stuff, right? So, and there wasn't a lot of information about how fish felt. Mm-hmm. And that at that time.
And there's a book now called How Fish Feel. I can give it to you.
Yeah, there's so much more information on that now.
There's a lot of information about it now, but not there wasn't a lot. I mean, this is going back like 40 years, mm-hmm. right? So by the time, I was a pescatarian for years and years and years, and I had a couple of children. By the time my son was about 5 or 6 years old, he was asking questions about why we ate fish. Mm. And I had a hard time justifying it. So I had to start looking into it again. It was another learning experience for me. And his prompting really helped me to, we got to the point where, you know, we ate less and less fish. And then pretty soon I took it out of the house completely. So we didn't eat fish at all. My daughter decided that she wanted to become pregnant, so she was looking into breastfeeding. And so we were vegetarians at that point, lacto-ovo vegetarians. And she came across some footage of calves being born and being wrenched away from their mothers, and their mothers crying for them, and the calves crying for their mothers. And she called me up and she said, "Mom, you know, I got some really bad news for you. This is what's happening. This is what dairy is, and I'm not eating dairy anymore."
Wow.
So I said, "Oh my God, now I can't eat dairy anymore."
You have a very open-minded family.
Yeah, yeah. So we stopped eating dairy, and it was very hard. Mm-hmm. Cheese was...
It was probably back in the day where there were no dairy alternatives, or
there was
soy milk that tasted like beans.
Exactly.
We're so lucky now; it's so much easier, right?
So we all stopped eating dairy because it just, you know, it was heart wrenching. We just couldn't, even though it was hard to give that taste up. It was, and cheese is very addictive, mm-hmm. so it was a withdrawal process for me and for the rest of them. And then the last to go, so that was about 6 years ago. Mm. And then the last to go was eggs. And I was buying my eggs from a small sort of backyard farmer who had a few chickens. And I thought, well, you know, these chickens are, it's okay because they're running around the yard and, you know, things are fine for them. And then I looked into it more closely and I realized that the male chicks still get killed, and the chickens are basically, you know, laying eggs. They're depleting their bodies, and it just wasn't the way to go. So I've been vegan for about probably, I guess, maybe four years now.
Wow.
But that's the journey, and I really feel for people that have that kind of a story, right? That it's hard to give those things up. But I just want to say, keep plugging away, because mm-hmm. you can get there.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Carol. That's beautiful. So now we're going to play for you a segment by the award-winning author and environmental journalist, George Monbiot.
A couple of years ago, I went down to spend the day beside this beautiful river in a really lovely part of the country. And it was a river which was meant to be thronging with life. There was meant to be water voles and salmon, kingfishers, and all these really amazing creatures. I couldn't wait. I was really excited. When we got to the river, it was dead. There was nothing in it except sewage fungus. That was the only living organism that I could see. Every other thing had been killed. I was just flabbergasted by this. This was meant to be a special nature site. And then I found this pipe just pouring filth into the river. And I followed it up to this dairy farm. That slurry, that cow shit, and filled up and was overtopping, and it was just pouring straight into the river. And I thought, this is an environmental disaster area. So I phoned the pollution hotline run by our agency in Britain called the Environment Agency. It's a bit like the Environmental Protection Agency in the US. 2 weeks later, I phoned them up again and said, so what have you done? Oh, we decided not to take any action, sir, because we don't think it's a serious pollution incident. I said, what do you mean it's not a serious pollution incident? It's wiped out the whole river. And they said, yes, sir, but we could find no evidence of a fish kill. I said, well, of course you couldn't find any evidence of a fish kill. There aren't any fish left to kill. And they said, well, thanks very much for your complaint, sir. Goodbye. Click. Drawer. And then I got two whistleblowers, both writing to me and said, this is routine. We've been instructed from the top not to enforce against incidents like this. Basically, dairy pollution, dairy farms is just wiping out rivers left, right and centre. And I thought, right, well, if they're not going to regulate this industry, I'm not going to buy its products. I don't want to be complicit in the destruction of these beautiful ecosystems. I then started looking around the world and saw that the problem isn't just meat. The problem is dairy in a big way. The livestock industry is inherently no more sustainable than the fossil fuel industry. The footprint of the global transport sector is pretty well the same as the footprint of animal agriculture. The rate of soil loss is now so great that we have 60 years of harvest left. And a lot of that is driven by the need to grow huge amount of crops in order to feed the animals, which we then eat. There's been a big drive to say, so what we need to do is to eat free-range meat instead. And all you're doing there is swapping one crisis, which is an animal welfare crisis, for a different one, which is an environmental crisis. That free-range beef and free-range sheep is even more environmentally damaging than the indoor intensive production of meat, because it's fantastically inefficient. You often hear people tell you, well, it's our destiny to eat meat. Look at our teeth. You can see from our dentition that we've eaten meat in the past. And sure, of course, yeah, absolutely. And we've killed people in the past, and we've set light to rainforests in the past, and a load of horrendous things in the past. That doesn't mean we have to keep doing them. We have choice. We have free will. I think if you want to go vegan, the first step is to start eating some vegan food. Go to a kebab shop and get a falafel. It's good vegan food. Thai food, some Southeast Asian cooking. There's some really amazing vegan meals you can do that way. And it's weird how your mind changes to accommodate the decisions that you make. It's a funny quirk of being human. And then quite unconsciously, we sort of justify that even to the extent of our senses. The taste of cheese is no longer pleasant to me. This thing I used to love, I don't love it anymore. It just does nothing for me at all. It's just grease on the tongue. So what would the impact of stopping eating animal products be? Well, the first impact, it means that we would use much less land than we currently use. A calculation suggests it would be between a third and a half of the land that we currently use. And the rest of that land, we can leave it to nature. We can allow nature to come back. It could be one of the very few ecological success stories anywhere in the world. We could see a great restoration, a great rewilding of nature. And that, to me, would be a wonderful thing. We can't detach ourselves anymore from the moral consequences of what we do. We can't say, oh, well, it's only me. What one person is doing is an aspect of what millions of people are doing, because we're all induced to do the similar sorts of things through market forces, through advertising, through marketing. So when you see those climate disasters, when you see people flooded out of their homes, when you see places turning into desert, when you see crops no longer being able to grow because it's too hot, when you see hurricanes intensifying and smashing everything up, 15% of that is because of what we're eating. Well, that alone is enough reason to change.
So that was the award-winning environmental activist, journalist, and writer George Monbiot. So Allison, you had some thoughts.
I really enjoyed watching that clip, and we're going to have it on our website at animalvoices.org and hopefully on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, because it comes with a video that you couldn't hear on the radio, of course, which is showing the slurry, the sludge, you want to call it, the sewage that's running into the river. So I know a lot of people think that they might think that dairy is a benign aspect of the animal agriculture industry, because I don't know, they just think that the cows are just there happily being milked, but think about all the waste that they produce, and it needs to go somewhere. So I just looked up some facts. Dairy, a cow will produce 19,000 pounds pounds of solid waste in a year. Wow. And 8,000 pounds of liquid waste in a year. And that all has to go somewhere. So where does it go? If you've watched the film Cowspiracy, by the way, you would know where it goes. Mm-hmm. But in this story in particular, and I know this is common, what they do is all the waste, all the sewage goes into a lagoon, which is next to the farm. A lagoon is basically this big, just this big pit, mm-hmm. this for poo. It's a big poo yeah. pit. It stinks. He was saying he wanted to gag when he kind of like saw the source of where it was coming from, the lagoon. And so the way these lagoons are managed, there's a lot of problems with them. I did learn that from Cowspiracy, and I've seen other. There was also Mark DeVries. He created the film Speciesism. He also created a short documentary where he bought a drone.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and he. So where can a drone go? It can go up where no other person can go. And he was showing footage of the drone flying over these fecal matter lagoons, sewage lagoons, because all those cows producing 19 pounds of solid waste, it needs to go somewhere. So in this particular story that George Monbiot was talking about, it was all going into one lagoon, which was then being transferred into a second lagoon, and then from there he found that a little river had emerged from the lagoon, and actually that river led into the main river, the actual river of water, and that killed all the fish. Mm-hmm. And there was fungal blooms above it. He took pictures and showed it on the web, and it looks really bad. Like he says, this isn't like those fungal blooms are an indication of environmental disaster. Right. But yet the environmental agency where he lives was unable to help them because they're being told not to help because the dairy industry is subsidized by the government. Mm-hmm. And you need to think about that when you're thinking about why these problems exist. So why do these problems exist? Basically, what it comes down to is because people enjoy eating cheese mm-hmm. and consuming dairy milk. Right? So, and I mean, Carol, you were just talking about how addictive cheese is. We've done shows on that before. Mm-hmm. Actually, cheese is known to be the number one addictive food in North America. Mm-hmm. And that usually comes on pizza. And it's because people have a hunger, a blind hunger for cheese, because they feel that they're entitled to this food because it's just so easy to go get from the grocery store, right? You just go there, you buy your 2 liters of cow's milk and your cheese, and you're set for consuming what you might think is good for you, consuming what your parents taught you to eat and have for breakfast every day. And I used to eat cheese every day. Yeah. I used to drink cow's milk every day.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and right. And these days there are so many options to not have to do that. It's actually like there's just no option. And not even if you live in a rural area, you can actually make your own non-dairy milk and cheese these days.
That's true. It's not just dairy also, right? It's also meat farms, hog farms.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That sort of thing.
They
have these massive waste lagoons that are
Like I was saying, the pig. And cows produce the most manure, though, because they're the largest animals.
Right.
But the pigs as well, that's it's a travesty. Like people who live, they're showing the film Cowspiracy, people who live in the areas of those lagoons, because that's all where they can afford to live, they have respiratory infections. Mm-hmm. And people who live in richer areas, they won't allow those places to be built by where they live because they have the money to refuse that. So anyways, I just wanted to leave this off saying that animal agriculture in itself is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, water pollution, as we've been talking about, and habitat destruction. And as George Monbiot says, go vegan, because should we not welcome this chance to change the world so swiftly and easily? Every move that we make is an impact on our ecosystem, and you can go vegan and make such a change. And watch Cowspiracy. It's on Netflix.
All right, yeah, absolutely. And along those lines, we can segue right into some news here. An unexpected source for encouraging veganism, IKEA. Furniture chain IKEA is promoting plant-based recipes for Earth Day in its current newsletter. And yeah, on its website, IKEA posted three recipes, three plant-based recipes, and they say celebrate Earth Day on April 22nd with mouth-wateringly healthy recipes made from plant-based ingredients you can grow at home. These recipes will boost your body and mind while bringing you closer to nature. In addition to launching a vegan version of its popular Swedish meatballs in 2015, IKEA announced in February that it would be expanding their plant-based hot dog, which they're currently testing in Sweden, and they're going to expand it to their European locations by August. So how about that, hey?
That's fantastic, yeah. So
now you can go to IKEA for vegan meatballs and hot dogs soon.
Yeah.
Not that I ever go there, but it's nice to know.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, but it's great to see such a big company that generally doesn't, they're a furniture company, but mm-hmm. they're still recognizing the impact that food choices are having.
And I hope Costco will follow, because I would go to their, crappy little eatery area there if they had anything anything to eat. If they had a maybe not so healthy veggie dog, I'd be there.
Absolutely. Another piece of news this week that was a little surprising. The latest celebrity to be quote unquote giving this vegan thing a try.
Doesn't sound like you're too trusting of this.
No, because this particular celebrity is Chef Gordon Ramsay.
No.
The vegan hater.
Yeah.
The vegan hater.
Yeah. He has mocked veganism several times in the media,
many
on Twitter,
times.
On TV.
I'm sure he dreams about it.
He's said all sorts of things, like no vegetarians allowed, etc.
He's also kills animals on his shows.
Really?
He said something like living a vegan lifestyle must be so pathetic and I'm so sad for them because they're not enjoying food.
Yeah.
He has said something to that.
And yet this week he posted a picture of a vegan pizza at his restaurant and he said, going to give this vegan thing a try. Yes, you guys heard that right. So we don't know exactly what that means, if he's actually ditched animal products or if he actually, we don't know how much he cares or what his motivations
are. Regardless, the moral of the story is that if that can happen, anything can.
Exactly. And also, Elise pointed out earlier this week, too, that some of the people who are most vocal against veganism are actually the ones who wind up doing it in the end, because they're clinging so hard. They care, but they're clinging so hard to these ideas, and then finally they just go, it's easier to just acknowledge the facts and give this a try, because why not, right?
I understand his wife is vegetarian or vegan, so that would be easy crossroads into it. Maybe there's some education there.
So here's hoping Gordon Ramsay comes out with some more vegan recipes for everybody.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, people evolve in surprising ways. So, all right, and now we're going to play for you an interview with Jane Goodall, Dr. Jane Goodall, the primatologist, on Democracy Now!
We turn to a renowned scientist, one of the world's leading voices on the issue of climate change and protecting the environment, Jane Goodall, the renowned primatologist, best known for her groundbreaking work with chimpanzees and baboons. I had a chance to speak to her last month in Paris at the UN Climate Change Summit.
I'm here really to talk about the importance of saving the rainforest as a way of mitigating climate change, because I know more about that than many of the other issues, although I talk about all of them.
Why is it important to save the rainforest?
Because they absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and as we cut them down and burn them, that CO2 is released back from the trees, the leaves, and also from the forest soils. And about 50% of our tropical rainforests have already gone. They're going at a tremendously fast rate, and even when they're protected in many countries, because of corruption, the power of the corporations, the worship of money and profit, the protection isn't always saving the forest.
You have recently been in the United States. You know there's a presidential election going on there. Can you talk about, especially in the Republican Party, the presidential candidates like the leading candidate, Donald Trump's, denial that climate change is caused by human beings overwhelmingly?
Well, I listened to Donald Trump saying, you know, that he doesn't believe that we've caused or are causing climate change, and some of the other right-wing leaders. And I just ask myself, do they really believe what they're saying? Because it seems so very obvious. And if you read the facts, I don't see how you can come to any other conclusion but that it's our misuse of fossil fuels, the emissions from agriculture, from industry, from households, the vast impact that's being made by this intensive farming of animals. And in order to feed the billions and billions of cows and pigs and chickens, even if you don't care about the cruelty, even if you refuse to admit that these are individuals with feelings who feel pain and have emotions, even if you don't admit that, you have to admit huge areas of forest are cut down to grow grain to feed them. Intensive cattle grazing is turning forest to woodland to scrubland. And food in one end, gas out both ends, that's methane, and that's an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. It's about 36% of all methane emissions come from this intensive farming.
Of cows?
Well, cows, pigs, the whole thing.
Can you talk about how diet fuels climate change and why you're a vegetarian?
I'm a vegetarian partly because, you know, I respect animals. I know they're all individuals. And I wouldn't eat a cow any more than I would eat my dog. That's the truth. And pigs are more intelligent than many dogs. But, you know, in addition, when you know the impact on the environment of this intensifying eating of meat, it's also true that being a vegetarian is more healthy. And so everything combined, I would be a vegan if I was in one place, but you have to be a bit careful if you're a vegan to get, you know, the right sort of nutrients and so forth. And as I'm 300 days a year on the road, vegetarian is sometimes hard, but I do stick to that.
What have you learned as a leading primatologist, expert in chimpanzees and baboons that most of us don't know?
I think it really started a long time ago when I went to study chimpanzees in 1960. I hadn't even been to college. And when I went to Cambridge 2 years later, because...
Where did you go to study?
Cambridge. I went to Gombe National Park in Tanzania. It was Tanganyika back then, all that time ago in 1960. And after I'd been there for about 2 years, my mentor, the late Louis Leakey, told me I had to get a degree. He got me a place in Cambridge straight into a PhD because he said there was no time for a BA. And imagine my shock when these erudite professors, of whom I was a little nervous, told me I'd done everything wrong, that I should have given the chimpanzees numbers, not names, that I couldn't talk about them having personalities, minds capable of problem solving, and certainly not emotions. Why? Because those were unique to us. And in fact, back then, it was generally thought that there was a sharp line between us and the rest of the animals, and it was a difference of kind. And it's so clearly a difference of degree, you know, with the same building blocks of life that we can trace through evolution coming up from very primitive sort of creatures and ending up in our bodies too. So basically, the chimpanzees opened the door for a new way of thinking about animals, to admit that we are not the only beings with personality, mind, and emotions. And that it makes us ask the question, but we are different. So what's the biggest difference? Development of the intellect. How is it possible that the most intellectual creature that's ever walked the planet is destroying its only home?
As you spend time at the UN Climate Change Summit 2015,
the one that has been considered the most important after Kyoto, because it's supposed to be a binding agreement. Though in the United States, President Obama says it can't be called a binding treaty, because then he'd have to put it through Congress. What have you been most struck by?
I think, you know, I've been to four other COPs. And I think the thing that's different is that there is, it's more of a sense of urgency, and there are far more people accepting the fact that climate change is for real. I mean, if you just look around the world on almost any day and you see what's happening, you know, England, half of England is flooded. People are dying in the DRC from floods. Go down to Namibia and it's getting drier and drier and drier. And we get these terrible storms. I mean, even in the UK last week, plane was diverted because the wind was so strong it couldn't land. And yes, these things have always happened, but they're happening faster and faster. The permafrost under the Tibetan plateau is melting way faster than science predicted. And if that releases all the methane into the atmosphere, it's going to just up climate change. And it's happening, and it's happening in Alaska, and it's happening in Greenland.
We were talking to climate scientist Kevin Anderson of the Tyndall Center, and he was criticizing climate scientists, saying they're censoring themselves, that no matter what is said, it's actually much worse.
They don't dare. They're not brave enough. It's always they want to sort of be very cautious and say if this and if that and perhaps and maybe. But it's just to the ordinary person who cares, especially if you travel like I do. I've seen it. I've lived long enough to see the change and to see how in the last 15 years or so it's just accelerated in the most terrifying way.
We're talking about the globe, the fate of the planet. How can one person make a difference?
Well, the thing is, it's not about one person. Can they make a difference? Everybody, every day, does make a difference. And if we think about the consequences of the choices we make, what we buy, what we eat, what we wear, and we start making the right ethical choices, then when that's multiplied a thousand, a million, a billion, several billion times, and we see the world moving towards change. So the most important thing is to give people hope. I've seen areas that have been destroyed that have come back to be beautiful again and support life. Nature is resilient. Animal species on the brink of extinction can be given another
chance. Like where?
Animals, well, I'm thinking of, I wrote a whole book called Hope for Animals and Their World, and I picked species that were, you know, the prime example in New Zealand was just two birds, one male and one female. And the scientist said, I'm not giving up. And these were in the wild, and there's now 500 of them on four different islands.
Thanks so much, Jane Goodall.
Thank you.
Jane Goodall, renowned primatologist, best known for her groundbreaking work with chimpanzees and baboons. I spoke to her last month in Paris, France, at the UN Climate Change Summit. To see all of our coverage, our 2 weeks of coverage there, you can go to democracynow.org.
Okay, so yes, again, that was Dr. Jane Goodall speaking with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! This interview obviously took place about a year and a half ago. She was referring to when Donald Trump was still running for president and that sort of thing, but obviously still very relevant. And I loved that somebody like Jane Goodall, with her influence, and you know, she has a big following, she's very famous, is very open about the impact of animal agriculture on the environment and how kind of dire it is, and how, you know, she, even as somebody who's an older person, I think she's in her 80s, you know, and is traveling a lot all the time in kind of remote areas, she still does her best to be, she said, as close to vegan as she can be in those circumstances, because of how important it is. And I love too her, she seems to always kind of put a spin of hopefulness on things. Mm-hmm. You know, she says if we take action on this, it is possible to reverse it. You know, she was talking about how she's seen wild areas return to being full of life and, you know, healthy ecosystems. And so it is possible. It's just kind of getting down to the wire, you know, we have to take action now. There's really no more time left to be procrastinating on this.
Well, apparently it's known that when humans are on the brink of disaster, that's when they will change. I watched a movie about that.
Right.
It was called Armageddon.
Oh, right, yeah. That's what it takes, right? Yeah. To be just no time left.
Need a comet heading our way.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's like, we're all going vegan if the comet will just shift over.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, come on, people, come on.
And then we'll start eating cheese again.
Yeah. So I think we can put that one on our website as well, that video, and on our Facebook page also, if anyone wants to watch it again or check it out.
Yeah, that I put that one up this morning.
Oh, good. Cool. Perfect. So Amir, you had some thoughts also on greenhouse gas emissions from factory farms.
Yeah, before that, I just wanted to say that when she talked about nature being resilient, it reminded me of a documentary I watched about Chernobyl, where that disaster happened, and how nature came back, and nobody ever thought that it would.
Yeah.
Not that we should, like, rest our laurels on that and just expect everything to come back,
well,
obviously.
Well, George Monbiot says this as well. It's that, like, 45% of our land's earth is covered with livestock. Crazy, huh? And he says that if everyone goes vegan, all that earth that's being used for raising animals and for raising crops to feed them, it will all go back to nature. So I have belief in that.
Yeah, I mean, as Elise was saying, greenhouse gas emissions obviously are a huge deal. And the effect animal agriculture has on our greenhouse gas emissions obviously have been talked about for well over 30 years. The advisory group on greenhouse gases was actually created in 1985. And one of the topics that was actually brought to the table even all those 33 years ago was the impact animal agriculture has on greenhouse gas emissions. But only in like the last 5 or 10 years, in my experience, has there been any real discussion about how to curb our emissions in that sector. And only in that time has it been brought into the mainstream sphere for discussion with, as Allison mentioned earlier, documentaries like Cowspiracy going viral. Animal agriculture obviously has a profound effect on our environment, with some reports stating it makes up for over a quarter of total emissions. I read a lot of reports in the last little while in preparation for today's show and was shocked to see that a lot of the conversation was about improving current systems of animal agriculture, but not necessarily ditching our dependence on it entirely. A recent report from the University of Michigan stated, on any given day, this is crazy, 20% of Americans account for nearly half of the U.S. diet-related greenhouse gas emissions, and high levels of beef consumption are largely responsible. So again, 20% of Americans account for nearly half of U.S. diet-related greenhouse gas emissions. They call this like impact diet or something, just people that consume so much of it that they have such a huge impact on it.
Yeah.
But this report was kind of contradictory because another researcher goes on to say, reducing the impact of our diets by eating fewer calories and less animal-based foods could achieve significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. So they say that
people aren't going to give up their calories in the U.S.
No, I know.
How about we just have more efficient calories and eat all the fruits and vegetables and plants that we want?
I mean, any report that you see will talk about how farming crops or just like potatoes and stuff like that have way less of an impact than, because what they do, as we've talked about on the show before, is they grow the food to feed the animals to feed the people instead of just growing the food to feed the people.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes, I think a lot of people don't realize this, it takes many times more plant crops to feed animals than it does to feed humans directly. I think it's about 16 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, like edible cow flesh, right? And I can't remember the figure for pork. I want to say it's about 9 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound.
I think I was just reading something like that too.
It's extremely inefficient. You could just be feeding, and it's often soybeans and stuff too that they feed to them. You could just be feeding these foods directly to people and it would go a lot further.
Yeah, a lot of the reports I've been seeing are sort of apologetic of the animal agriculture industry and sort of giving them hope instead of, again, what I would feel like is the easier route to go, and just like saying, you know, we don't need it as much, but more so just touting this idea that there is ways to improve it again, or like reducing like the way they do their business and stuff, instead of, again, just taking our minds off of it completely, which I find weird.
Yeah.
So these are climate scientists, I presume, who are writing these reports?
Yeah, a lot of them are actually university reports.
Of course. So they need to get in touch with the clean meat people. because those two sides need to be working together. So for people who don't know what clean meat, it's something that I believe is going to change the world and actually solve our environmental problems. It's lab-grown, cell-cultured meat that doesn't use an animal, apparently doesn't kill an animal, and you can grow whatever muscle tissue you want, and it's already out there. Like, you can grow any kind of animal, you can grow any part of the animal without the fat, without the bones and the ligaments, and that is what's coming in the future, and I believe that that is going to satisfy the meat eaters out there who will just never have a chance, just won't give up their meat.
At the same time, I would emphasize to anybody listening, I just hear the clean meat come up in conversation and people say, yeah, that's going to change everything. And they just continue eating the way that they are.
Right.
And
it's for those people.
Yeah.
In the meantime, please go vegan.
Yeah, in the meantime, right? The more animal products you consume right now, the worse things will continue to get. That's just the reality of it.
If you go vegan, you're saving 200 animals in a year right away. Like, how good does that feel?
And it's and I've also heard a lot of people talk about how, you know, if you talk about the dairy industry, people will say, oh, well, almond milk's no better because this is all, that's really water intensive and these are all the problems with that. Soy milk, there's all these problems with soy, which of course are driven by the fact that soybeans are fed to livestock and to farmed animals.
So, I think it's 80% of soy grown
is 85% globally.
Up to 85 now. And in corn is going, goes to feed animals that are used to eat.
So people are really just not recognizing the significant impact that just changing what we're eating can have. So as Jane Goodall said, you're not powerless to make a difference. You are making a difference. So you can just change your habits every day, and that helps.
Even when people talk about, you know, almonds being water intensive, it's true for a plant crop. Almonds are water intensive, but they still are significantly less they take significantly less water to produce than dairy.
And if you really care about that, if almonds are your issue, there's so many other plant milks out there that you can be drinking.
Exactly. Oat milk, rice milk, soy milk,
milk.
You got options.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, more and more these days. And the thing is, too, I agree that there are maybe a small number of people who just would refuse to give up animal flesh under any circumstance. And I think that the whole clean meat thing, the lab-grown meat, will be a huge benefit for that. But then at the same time, I think we live in a time now where there are alternatives being developed, plant-based alternatives, that are pretty much indistinguishable from animal flesh. Stuff like the Impossible Burger.
Some
Beyond
of them
Burger.
I won't eat because they're too close.
I've heard a lot of vegans say that.
I don't think I'll ever eat another Beyond Burger. That just, like, just gave me memories of McDonald's in grade 12 so bad. And just, I just could never do that again. But for the people who want to, it's vegan. Go for it.
Exactly. I've heard a lot of longer-term vegans say that it resembles meat too much and it creeps them out. But somebody loves animal flesh, then that's, you know, a viable alternative, and they're becoming so much more available now, widely available. And the same with dairy alternatives. The vegan cheeses are getting better and stuff. You really just, any taste or texture that you miss, you don't have to miss anything. You can just have a wonderfully varied diet and not eat any animals. There are so many. Obviously, as Amir was talking about, they're just, like, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from animal agriculture dwarfs the amount by any plant crop. And there's other issues. Allison was speaking earlier about water pollution. Air pollution is a huge problem from factory farms in particular, but all kinds of animal farms. And I wanted to share some information from the Food Empowerment Project website, which is fantastic, by the way. I highly recommend checking it out, foodispower.org. They talk a lot about not only the impact of farming on animals themselves, but also on how they affect human beings, especially marginalized people who work in slaughterhouses and factory farms. And there's a section in it, an article on environmental racism, and this is basically talking about how living in close proximity to animal farms affects the health of particularly people of color and marginalized people, poor people. Air pollution is a huge thing. It says here, air pollution poses risks to vulnerable members of populations near factory farms, specifically children, the elderly, and individuals with pre-existing respiratory diseases. In particular, epidemiological studies on factory farm emissions show strong correlations between these pollutants and asthma. The results from surveys of rural North Carolina schools also showed strong correlations between asthma diagnoses and proximity to factory farms. Schools with a significant number of students of color, about 37%, and slightly less than half of the student bodies on reduced lunch programs, were located an average of 4.9 miles from pig factory farms, yet schools with more white and higher income students were found to be an average of 10.8 miles away, so about twice as far away. Significant correlations were also found between race, poverty, and the odor exposure from these pig factory farms. So, you know, I think vegans and animal rights activists often get people saying to us, like, you know, why are you just advocating for animals? Why don't you care about other humans, you know, marginalized people? But all of it relates, you know. And
we're all animals.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right?
And so, yeah, all of this, you know, animal farming has a significant impact on all people, but especially the most vulnerable, the most marginalized people. So that's something that's, you know, there's just obviously so many different things to think about, but that's also something that we want to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, you know, in the way things are today, you turn on the news, there are 100 things to feel sad and frustrated and angry about with regards to oppression of humans and destruction of the environment and oppression to animals, non-human animals. And yeah, it's easy to feel powerless, but that's one of the things, you know, when people say, why are you focusing on animals when, you know, when humans have all these problems, as you say, it's all connected. And this is something that people can do. This is why I love vegan advocacy, because it's a way to help a lot of things at once, and mm-hmm. it's something that a lot of people can do. You go into the grocery store, you just reach for something else instead. Mm-hmm. You go to a restaurant, you just order something else instead, and you are making a difference. And yeah, people tend to feel powerless or angry or point their fingers at government and big corporations, who of course have responsibility here and need to be held accountable. But a lot of these horrible practices and the horrible stuff resulting from them in animal farms, this is only happening because people keep paying for it every day at the supermarket.
Supply and demand is simple economics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to talk about an alternative, too. You know, one of the main sources of protein for vegans is legumes, or sometimes they're called pulses. This is like lentils, beans, peas, etc., things in that family. And the amazing thing about pulses, I think it was the Food and Agriculture Organization made 2016 the International Year of Pulses because they wanted to highlight what a great alternative these foods are to animal foods, to animal protein. And the great thing about them is that they not only take orders of magnitude fewer resources to produce, but they also have positive benefits for the soil and for the environment. So I was just looking at the website for the International Year of Pulses 2016, and they're talking about how pulses play an important role for sustainability in many ways. They're an important component of crop rotations. They require less fertilizer than other crops, and they are a low-carbon source of protein. Farmers use them to maintain soil fertility. So in Canada, for example, where pulses are often integrated in good soil management practices, a good crop rotation includes a variety of crops grown in sequence, including cereal grains, oil seeds, and legumes or pulses. And the pulses have a positive impact on soil quality because they help fix nitrogen in the soil. So this helps contribute to higher yields in subsequent crop rotations. However, it's not the only reason. pulses have a direct positive impact on soil quality because they help feed soil microbes, which benefits soil health. And I think this is so compelling because we know that animal farming tends to deplete soil health. It kills mm-hmm. those beneficial microbes and takes nutrients out of the soil and depletes, you know, topsoil and that kind of thing. So pulses have exactly the opposite effect. They've also been shown to produce greater amounts and different types of amino acids than non-legumes, and the plant residues left after harvesting pulse crops have a different biochemical composition than other crop residues. And also they're a protein source with a low footprint in both carbon and water. For instance, the water footprints to produce a kilogram of beef, pork, chicken, and soybeans are 43, 18, 11, and 5 times higher than the water footprint of pulses. So they have a very, very low water footprint and a very low carbon footprint. It's just a no-brainer. I mean, we can use, for example, lentils and beans, they're extremely high in protein, they're high in iron, they're high in all kinds of vitamins and minerals, and they're an excellent alternative to meat and other animal products.
And they're cheap, too. They're affordable.
Yeah, they're some of the cheapest foods you can get.
How much can you get like, for a big bag of lentils?
It depends on where you live exactly, but I think, lentils are cheap. Super, super cheap. Definitely much less expensive than meat. So,
bean burgers versus beef burgers. You can make a lot more of them for the same amount of money.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You don't have to just eat cooked beans or lentils. You can make all kinds of stuff out of them. Mm-hmm. So they're very versatile.
How do you save the planet? Eat delicious things,
right?
Like,
Carol, do you have any thoughts on this, just to wrap up?
Well, during my journey, I've had to change the way I cook over and over and over again, and I find that actually getting into the whole bean and lentil thing, it's pretty easy once mm-hmm. you start it. It's not like a big change. It's just knowing, do I have to soak it for how long, that kind of thing. And there's tons of recipes, just delicious recipes out there. There is a bit of a maybe gas issue sometimes.
At first.
But once you get used to it, your body adjusts to that, and that goes away.
I've heard you just need to soak the beans and drain and rinse that water off.
Helps. That helps a lot. Yeah.
It does help, absolutely.
There's a tip.
Yeah.
For Earth Day.
Right.
Yeah. But more importantly, thank you for, letting our listeners know it's accessible. It's easy. Try some bean recipes for Earth Day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just Google online vegan bean recipe.
And you can get them anywhere. That's the other thing, too. They're very easy to find.
They are.
Any store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Anytime you're feeling hopeless about the environment or you wish you could do something, just try a different plant-based recipe and you're helping.
Yeah, that's true. It's a baby step in the right direction.
Good idea. Mm.
So moving on to events now.
Events for today, Friday, April 20th. Well, at 2 p.m., there's a very vegan 420 meet at the Engagement Rings Art Installation at Sunset Beach, Vancouver. This is a 19-plus event. And tonight, from 6 to 8 p.m., Dr. Chandra Sekera is giving a talk entitled Beyond Animal Testing, New Approaches in Medical Research. This is being held at Van Dusen Botanical Gardens, which is at 5151 Oak Street in Vancouver. You can get your tickets at Eventbrite. I think they're $20. Tomorrow, April 21st, from 3 to 5:30 p.m., Anonymous for the Voiceless and Direct Action Everywhere are teaming up for a Cube of Truth demonstration. This is being held at Memorial Peace Park in Maple Ridge, which is 11900224th Street, Maple Ridge. And then April 27th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., it's a Friday, at the Science World, there's a children's animal welfare. So animal and environmental groups have put together a day for children ages 8 and up to learn more about animals and the environment. And they get a little passport. They can run around and get them all stamped at the different sections. So that's at Science World at 1455 Quebec Street.
Right, that's welfare with F-A-I-R, right?
Yes.
Little play on words.
Yes,
yeah.
Play on words. And regular admission rates apply to that.
Saturday, April 28th until Sunday, May 6th, John and Ocean Robbins, a father and son team, are hosting the 7th Annual Food Revolution Summit. This is an online event and it features 24 medical and food experts. You can learn new ways to help your body and the planet based on wholesome plant-based diets. You can sign up for this event free at www.foodrevolutionsummit.org. And I think this will be on our Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I highly recommend this Food Revolution Summit. They've been doing it for years and it's free content. It's free for, I think, 24 hours after it broadcasts. So take advantage of it. I've learned so much from health professionals, and John Robbins, he's one of the revolutionaries of the vegan lifestyle.
He was an heir to Baskin Robbins.
That's right.
And then
he sure was.
He gave that up
because dairy's evil.
Yeah.
And he went vegan. Read all about it in Diet for a New America.
Yeah. Diet for a New America. That's right.
Yeah. I think the next time you see a Baskin Robbins, think about John Robbins. Yeah.
John and his son Ocean Robbins. Right. That's right. And also, just mark your calendar now for Powell River's first Veg Fest. It's being held May 12th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., featuring delicious food, cooking demos, vegan products, and inspiring speakers. More information at prvegfest2018@gmail.com. And I think that's also going to be on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
Great.
Great. Thank you for that, Carol. So if you have an animal-related event that you would like us to share on the show, please email it to us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please tune in to the show next week when we'll talk about World Week for Animals in Labs with a feature interview with Dr. Charu Chandrasekara. I'm sure I messed that one up. I'm sorry, doctor. She's the director of lab science with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and she's spearheading the move to take animals out of the labs and to do more thorough and humane testing through a different methods. So tune into that. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream our shows or download the shows as podcasts. We can read the show blog with detailed links and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our face page at Animal Voices Vancouver and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To end the show today, we have a song specially selected for Earth Day called Emergency on Planet Earth by
Jamiroquai.
Stay tuned afterwards for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thanks so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals, even the human ones.